The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with John Gilroy of Lectromech, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts about some of the IT trends and challenges facing agencies and industry. Now your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio this morning, we are lucky enough to have Dr. Thomas Cellucci. He's a chairman and chief executive officer at a company called Ecrypt Technologies. That's like a little teeny part of your background. That's like not even a line on a 100-page resume, is it? And I was about to come up with an introduction for him, but I went out of paper. I'm printing off this books and this and everything else. 24 books, 192 articles. First commercialization officer of the federal government. But I'm running out of breath. Tell us about your background, Tom.
Thanks so much, John. It's great to be with you here today. Basically, I'm a laser physicist type who went to business school. And after I sold my fourth high-tech company, this was in 2006, I knew some people in government. I had the great privilege of working with people, including President Clinton, on what later became the National Nanotechnology Initiative. I worked with a new President Bush when a member of my family, Paul Cellucci, who then was the governor of Massachusetts, used to work with then-Governor George W. Bush. And you know, after I had sold this company, I was talking to many of my friends, including people from Washington, and they said, look, you made enough money, go do something to help the government. And I kind of laughed at them and said, look, I'm not interested in politics. No, you don't have to do politics, Tom. What you need to do is use your business skills because the people in the government would really appreciate it. So to make a long story short, I became the first chief commercialization officer and went to DHS, where they had some pressing issues. It was a wonderful experience. I worked for both the Bush and Obama administrations. I wouldn't have traded in those 4 years for anything. While I gave up a lot of money, all of the great people I met and the ability to help my country has been one of my most wonderful memories to date in my career.
So the title of today's interview is Innovation and the Federal Government. And who better to bring in the studio and talk about innovation? You know, I had a fellow named Todd Park who sat in that chair a few years back, almost similar type story, very successful, very aggressive, articulate. He said, you know, he wanted to help the healthcare system. He came in and he came up with a lot of new concepts like Presidential Innovation Fellows. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. So we've got the federal government here. We got a lot of challenges, security challenges, healthcare challenges, personnel, people, you know, budgets being pulled back, personnel being pulled back. And I think if there is any area that's ripe for innovation, it's got to be my listeners, the govies.
Absolutely. And I have to say, I came to government with a simple hypothesis that the private sector would be ready, willing, and able to help the government, in this case, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, if the government gave them two things, neither of which were money, believe it or not. The money comes later. The first would be detailed operational requirements. That is, the government does not do a great job in articulating its problems. So it needs to really understand how to articulate or supply operational requirements. And the second thing that govies don't really realize, and I use the word govie affectionately because I was one, is that govies really don't think of themselves as leveraging powerful markets and market segments. But I can tell you, working all over the world, that the U.S. federal government is extremely attractive to companies all around the globe because the markets are so sizable. And so I came with a simple hypothesis that the private sector was ready, willing, and able to help us at DHS if we gave them detailed operational requirements and a conservative estimate of the potential available markets. And I'll be glad to help your listeners with some of the PowerPoints that have all been released and are still on the internet if they're interested. But the model worked beautifully, and the hypothesis was proven correct in a relatively short time. We had CEOs of companies that never thought of working with the federal government coming to us at DHS. And I'm very proud to tell you that our innovative commercialization-based public-private partnership yielded in months, not years, new technologies, capabilities that really made a difference in securing our nation. I'm very, very proud to say that in relatively a short amount of time, I'm talking less than 6 months, we were able, at virtually no cost to the U.S. taxpayer, able to develop technologies and capabilities in, for example, the case of forensic explosion-proof cameras that created the technology that was used to catch those two people in the Boston Marathon bombing. I'm very, very proud of that. And that was because of innovative, above-board interaction between the private sector and the public sector.
In front of you is not only a microphone, but also a book. This is a guide to innovative public-private partnerships. I think that's a good place to start for my listeners, isn't it? I mean, pick up the book, read it. If you got challenges, think differently. Maybe hit yourself over the head with the book, maybe read it. But this might help you with challenges that everyone's facing that's listening to this interview.
Absolutely, John. I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you that this is my 23rd book. It's a very popular textbook on Amazon, and it really outlines in detail all the processes and procedures that can still be used today by the U.S. government, and for that matter, for governments and entities all over the world. I'm very honored to have been able to serve my country in both the Obama and Bush administrations. Everyone knew me as a non-political type, but someone was just interested in the work. And it's been extremely gratifying that I'm constantly being called back to our government to help various agencies start implementing their own versions of what we call the SECURE program at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
And that was a program that you initiated at DHS, is that right?
That's correct, John.
Tell us a little bit about that, some of the challenges you had. And, I mean, you're just some guy from nowhere coming in. Who is this guy?
Exactly.
He's some physicist guy with a funny last name. What does he know? It's like Tesla. What does he possibly know?
It was great. And I have to say, without exception, I worked for both President Bush, President Obama, Secretary Chertoff, Secretary Napolitano. And I have to tell you, they were not only supportive of these models we developed, they embraced them. And I always tell people, at the end of the day, when it came to security, I don't care what political party's in office, the presidents of the United States really do care about the security of our people. And they embrace these models. And basically, as I said, the hypothesis was that the private sector would be ready, willing, and able to help the U.S. government. But of course, the government had to ensure that things were done in an open and transparent way. So what the SECURE program basically was, we put out detailed operational requirements and what are called CONOPs, concepts of operations, and put these out in an open and transparent way for some problems that we had in the government. We opened it up to any entity who wanted to come. Those that went through a checklist that we looked at that were realistic entities that could do what they said they could do, we signed what's called a CRADA agreement, a Cooperative Research and Development Agreement, and we gave them no money. And basically what we did is we had a certification program. If, in fact, they could provide third-party independent test and evaluation data that their product, service, or capability could meet the requirements that we had generated, we would actually certify that product. And being a market-driven economy, it created competition because we could certify, in principle, many different technologies, capabilities, products, or services. And what it did is it increased performance, lowered price, and companies were coming to us that never would have thought to work with the government. And that certification seal meant the world to these companies because they could share in the imprimatur of DHS. Of course, a government agency can't endorse a product or service. So this was a beautiful model that worked extremely well. And I will have to tell you that I now get asked to go to the Department of Defense at the highest levels, HHS, and other places to share the model and experience. I will tell you that there were challenges. And the only real challenge was that at that time, the govies, because this was new, they got a little nervous because in Govy land, it was all about how many people respond, worked for you, and what your budgets were. This actually could threaten that, and that was the only challenge.
Let's take a break and come back, talk more about innovation, maybe frame it as far as some famous authors who've written about innovation and how it can be applied to the federal government. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM in the studio. Dr. Thomas A. Salucci, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of the company called Ecrypt Technologies. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. In the studio this morning, we have Dr. Thomas Salucci. He is the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Ecrypt Technologies. He has a quite interesting career with a PhD and an MBA, 24 books. In fact, he has a book in front of him, and he is currently working for a company called ECRYPT. And you can visit their site at ecryptinc.com. You know, Tom, you could work for any McDonald's in town here. Why are you working for Ecrypt? I mean, come on now. You've got talent, buddy.
great question, John. The true story on how I got introduced to Ecrypt, a number of the former board members of Ecrypt I had known from my days in government, and several of them called me up and said, "Hey, Tommy, look, we're govies and we're retired military, etc. This is a wonderful company. It's a publicly traded company. It's been in existence 7 years, but they don't have any revenue. They don't have any products, but they do have what we believe is interesting and valuable technology." So to make a long story short, I did due diligence as a board member. I accepted a board member position, and I just asked what I considered the normal questions a board member asks, being on about 20 boards now. And within 2 weeks, the management and many of the investors in the company said, "Hey, look, Tommy, what would it take for you to become the CEO?" John, I was like, "Oh, no." And so I put out an amount of stock that it would require. And I had done my due diligence on the technology. It's patent pending. And I was very, very impressed with it. So to make a long story short, a year later, I'm very proud to tell you we have five products under the label of Ecrypt One software. We already made an acquisition of what we call a system. It's actually a security portfolio company that has three types of offerings: software, tools, and systems. And I'm very proud to say that the company does now have products and revenue and is doing well.
I was tweeting this morning about an article from Wired Magazine. They talked about people hacking into medical devices. And I'm thinking to myself, I used to be worried about someone hacking into my car. Now I'm in the hospital, I'm doing a process procedure, and old Tom's in the next room there, he's hacking in. Oh, you gave me a hard time on the radio. And so he gives me, I mean, if there's ever a need for encryption somewhere in the world today, it's got to be right here and right now.
Oh, John, you couldn't be more correct. I mean, there are threat vectors everywhere. And in fact, why our products are so popular and gaining popularity, particularly with the government, our Ecrypt One is a patent-pending, security-first, full-service email system. When you look at things like the hacking at OPM, the continuous problems you read in the newspaper about the targets, the Neiman Marcuses of the world, we take a very unique approach. If you go onto the website, ecryptinc.com, you'll see five ebooks where we explain how our software takes a whitelist approach and what's very unique and differentiated in our email security solutions. It's very, very important. In fact, we have what's called a marketing alliance program at the company, and one of our highly sought after capabilities with some of our clients is what we call KGSS capabilities. This is the Kaspersky Government Security Solutions. They provide proprietary cyber threat information repositories with literally petabytes of previously unavailable threat information. Just think about all of the different threats from around the world. And it's been an honor for me to work with some of our leaders
like
in the U.S. government.
Adam Firestone.
Exactly. Adam Firestone is the president of KGSS, just a wonderful person to work with, has extremely unique capabilities, and it's an honor for me to introduce those folks to people in the government who really need this information to keep our public and private sector entities protected.
I did a live TV show with Adam about 6 months ago. I thought the title of the show was going to be Two Ugly Guys. We talked about studying information technology at, of all places, at Georgetown University. So I know Adam from way back. You know, when I think about innovation, I have my students read the classic book called The Innovator's Dilemma. 1997. I mean, this is a classic book. And he uses this phrase that everyone probably in the whole world has used this phrase now, called disruptive and being disruptive and disruptive innovation. So what do you think of this character? Is he worth reading? Is this a book before or after they read yours?
Yeah, they talk about it. And I believe in you know, creating disruptive and enabling technologies. But I like to just step back, if I could, John, to say, you know, you hear the word innovation so often now, it's almost becoming a puff word. You hear it not only from the U.S. government officials, you hear it by private sector people, you hear the phrases innovator, die, etc. But I would tell you that I need to segment or differentiate things into invention, innovation, and finally commercialization. And I will tell you, in my humble opinion, the U.S. has lost ground in a couple of these areas. I still very much believe that the United States is the leader of invention, that is creating technology. And the simple reason or proof I have of that is I happen to be on the board of trustees and a professor at Virginia International University. And these are students literally from all over the world. Most countries around the world still send their brightest to the United States university system to learn.
For now.
For now. Yeah. And that's why I think innovation is still number one. Innovation is really the application, the first applications of invention. And finally, and I think most importantly, commercialization, which broadly defined is the recognition or development of a market and the design and deployment of services and or products to meet the needs of that market, is the most critical, because that's where the money generation comes from. And I spend a lot of time going all over the world talking to various governments, as well as our own, to see how can government spur on the idea of commercialization. Because it's not the invention, but it's the commercialization of technology that creates revenue and a tax base for a region, a country, a nation, et cetera.
You know, many, many, many years ago when I was in high school, the old joke was, oh, that's my name, don't wear it out. You know, that's back in St. Joe's High School. And I think about the word innovation, maybe it's getting worn out. If you go to LinkedIn, you know, there's 14,000 groups that are dedicated to innovation on LinkedIn alone. There are companies, there are 114,000 companies on LinkedIn that use innovation as one of their keywords. I mean, it is almost getting me, innovation, okay. Everyone, no, you were doing innovation before innovation was cool. I mean, you were the pioneer in this years ago. I mean, you were the first guy in the street with, hey, what's this guy with innovation in his title, commercialization of the federal government? What are you doing? I mean, this was a challenge, I think.
I think you're exactly correct, John. And in fact, I think the word innovation gets overused now, and it's almost become what I call a puff word. I used to be in the nanotech space, and I saw an analogous phenomenon where everybody was using the word nano because there was money involved. I was very proud to work with President Clinton, as well as President George W. Bush. And I think it was the only thing that the Bush administration kept from the Clinton administration. And I was involved in the National Nanotechnology Initiative as a private sector executive, and then later as a govy. And everyone overused it. And that's the issue. It's really, what do you mean by innovation? And what processes are you utilizing to generate innovative products and services?
Let's drill down more with my listeners, federal information technology professionals. Do you think they do a pretty good job of gathering requirements?
I will have to tell you, I'm both proud and embarrassed to say to you, John, that I wrote 8 books while I was in the federal government, and these are still available. I think I gave you some of the covers to show your audience on your websites. Basically, I will have to tell you that my experience had been that government officials, not that they're any worse than people I've met in the private sector, they're not particularly good at articulating their problems. And that's what requirements are, a detailed description of a problem. They are not the solution. That's what specifications are. And so often I would go throughout our government while a govy, and I would ask people, tell me the problem you're trying to solve. And it was very difficult for them to articulate. So one of the first books I wrote was How to Address the Requirements Issue. And, you know, sometimes it is very difficult to write requirements, but you don't just have to write something down at a desk. For example, if you look at the old story of L.L. Bean, you know, they make that funky boot. That's kind of their flagship product, mm-hmm. That funky boot that fishermen, hunters, etc. use. Well, that wasn't designed because someone wrote down requirements. people from L.L. Bean went into the field. They looked at what fishermen and hunters were doing, and they developed the requirements from observation. So there are many, many books. It's amazing to me. Many of them are sold on eBay, although I did them all, of course, as a government official for free. You could ask your audience to email me and I can send them links, or they can just look up Cellucci plus DHS plus requirements and find those books.
Yeah, and that's C-E-L-L-U-C-C-I. I'm sure you can Google that and you can find out any one of these books. Let's take a break and come back. Let's talk more about innovation in the federal government and talk about maybe some social media involved in that area as well. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio this morning, we have Dr. Thomas Cellucci, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer at Ecrypt Technologies. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio this morning, we have Dr. Tom Cellucci, he's PhD, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer at Ecrypt Technologies. We've been bouncing around talking about innovation in the federal government, and there are all kinds of different acronyms and terms that we can throw around, and we can talk about TRLs and MRLs. But really, when you're talking to a federal information technology professional, maybe a project manager burdened with some kind of a difficult project, where do you start with innovation? Where's the first place to go?
Oh, that's a great question, John. One of the things I do is I, share my experiences with them. I've developed a lot of tools that I gladly give to people in the federal government. For example, something that's very, very popular is what I call a product realization guide, which takes a program manager or even a senior executive from their early stages of trying to discover what the requirements are all the way to the full deployment of a product, a service, a software project, et cetera. It's available. If any of your listeners would like me to send it to them, they can send me an email at tom.cellucci@ecryptinc.com. I also can provide it on your website. This is actually something that people in the private sector can use, the public sector. It's a very, very popular guide, and it takes someone through all the detail from going from the discovery of the problem and articulation of the requirements all the way to the full development of a solution.
You know, many conversations these days take place on social media. And if you want to follow Ecrypt, you can go to @Ecrypt. If you want to follow me for whatever reason, I'm @RayGilRay. And we're also available as a podcast. So you can go to Apple Store and you can download this. So if you have friends in California, you can say, hey, I made a fool of myself, and you can listen to the podcast. So we're available all over the place. Of course, this is available streaming. And Tom has a tough name, but it's C-E-L-L-U-C-C-I. I'm sure if you Google that, you'll find all kinds of links to get these books and get all kinds of information about innovation in the federal government. And I don't know how else you're going to solve the problems here. And many times necessity is the mother of innovation. And we have my listeners, and I talk to them all the time, is, yeah, they got these big projects. They're getting pulled back. They don't have any budget for this. Hard to keep young people because you're getting pulled off by companies. And so there's a lot of challenges that they have, but you have to think creatively and originally and think like Clayton does and think like you do and maybe use some of the tools that you're providing them as well.
And I would also say, John, there are organizations. For example, I attended a board meeting yesterday of a group I'm very proud to be a board member. It's called NCOIC, the Network Centric Operations Industry Consortium. And many of the board members are retired 3- and 4-star generals and admirals, and I'm very honored to be among those board member colleagues. And they really focus on accelerating global interoperability. We had a guest speaker yesterday from the FAA, and she was very open and forthright to explain some of the issues that FAA has in terms of creating innovation. A couple of weeks ago, I went to the Pentagon to talk to the Secretary of Defense's folks about accelerating the development of products and services of use for the Department of Defense. There's also, for example, I'm on the board of directors of a wonderful organization called the Security Industry Association. And this is another organization that can bring people together, can help with best practices. So there are more and more resources out there for people in the federal government to tap into to not have to reinvent the wheel, but gather lessons from some of these organizations, most of which are nonprofit that I just mentioned.
We're right in the middle of Nationals baseball season, but a lot of people listen to these podcasts, these interviews, 6-7 months later. There's snow on the ground. So let's say someone from Commerce is listening to this podcast. It's 2 o'clock in the morning and they're typing out emails or something. They're listening and they're saying, well, give us an example of success and failure and what did you learn from some of these attempts at innovation?
Oh, that's wonderful. One of the things that I mentioned earlier in our interview is that within 3 to 4 months, when I first joined the government and when I decided to go to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, I received from Michael Chertoff, then Secretary of Homeland Security, a simple request. He said, Tommy, I am very concerned about transportation vehicles, buses, trains, etc. Is it possible to address some of the issues if, God forbid, something goes wrong, that we could trace back? And so what we did is we wrote a set of requirements for an explosive-resistant forensic camera that had to be very low price. And I'm very proud to tell you, in less than 3 months, we had working prototypes. CNN had done some stories on this. And that very technology was used to catch recently those two from the Boston Marathon.
So what are the attributes of good versus not so good innovation for the federal government?
Well, the bottom line is it all starts with requirements, John. It's very, very important on the onset to really understand the problem you're trying to address. And very often people do what I call the technology push approach. Let's just put something out there and, you know, build it and they will come. I have to tell you, as a seasoned senior executive for many, many years, 30 plus years, that's usually not the way it works. It's much higher probability if you're able to develop requirements because you've talked to many prospective clients, customers, learn what the problem is, and then develop the technology to solve those problems.
I get in discussions all the time with young people and they say, well, I don't, you know, stink in college. Well, Steve Jobs didn't go to college. And my response always is, you're no Steve Jobs. you're no Bill Gates. I mean, you know, what you have to do is very few people can actually imagine what consumers or what customers are going to need 4 or 5 years down the road. I think it has to be much more methodical than it. That insight is very rare. I think there's other ways to accomplish innovation besides the genius level innovation.
I think you're totally correct, John. Look, there's a difference between intelligence and experience and wisdom. And I will tell you, there's a reason why I have gray hair. I've made a lot of mistakes, but with those mistakes, you can learn. And the reality is hopefully when you go to an institution where you take courses, you not only learn from the professors and teachers there, but you can learn from the other students' experiences. As I tell people, although I went to an Ivy League school for my PhD, I learned more from the other graduate students than I ever did from a professor. And now being a professor myself at Virginia International University, I tell students, learn from one another because you come from so many different cultures around the world, particularly when I'm teaching a course in the MBA school. That's where you get to learn and that's where you get to tap into other people's experiences. My attitude is simple. Ask someone who's got the scars on their back. Because they'll be able, I tell young people all the time, that's a great idea, but did you consider A, B, C, and D, which I didn't, that's why it failed, so learn from that. And that's what school can help you with.
You know, school always has metrics. They're called grades. And managers always have metrics too, you know. You know, if you can measure it, you can manage it. Now, there's arguments there many different ways. So how does someone evaluate innovation? I mean, if you had five people working for you and you had a challenge, whether it's a bomb-resistant camera or a car that gets more mileage or trying to figure out where the FEMA trailers are, how would you measure progress?
That's a great question, John. And, you know, very often if I had a dollar for every person in R&D that came to me and said, you know, Tom, you can't measure R&D. And that is nonsense. You can't predict with certainty the outcome of R&D efforts, but you certainly can measure things like cost, can create milestones and look at progress against the milestone goals, for et cetera. And you can have backup solutions that you could potentially look at. So, for example, in product development efforts, I look at things like cost. and I utilize test and evaluation, T&E, against requirements. And we look at surveys, for example, of prospective clients. We use Delphi focus groups to see if we're on the right track. I learned a long time ago, always keep the end user or the customer or client in the process.
You use Delphi focus groups, and I use the Oracle from Delphi. So two different approaches to what's going to happen in the future. Let's not talk about the Oracle of Delphi anymore. Let's come back. We'll talk about innovation, and we're talking, by the way, with the Oracle of the Potomac here, Tom Salucci. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Let's take a break, come back, talk more about federal innovation. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, we have Dr. Tom Salucci. He's Chairman and Chief Executive Officer at Equipped Technologies. If you'd like more information about Equipped, you have to spell it out. It's ECRYPTINC.com. Get more information about the company. If you'd like more from Tom, if you want to get one of his books, his articles, he's got tons and tons available. It's a tough spelling name. It's C as in Charlie, C-E-L-L-U-C-C-I. I'm sure if you Google that, you go to Amazon, you go to eBay, you can find all kinds of information. He's got a book right in front of him on innovation. We've been talking about all kinds of innovation concepts. One is Twitter. A lot of people are on Twitter, and you can follow Tom and his company at ECRYPT. There's no N in there. It's ECRYPT, and find out about all kinds of adventures. Maybe watch him speak at a local conference. You know what happens, Tom, is people listen to people like interview on the air, and they go, seems like a smart guy. Now, what kind of phone did he have? And what is he really like? What's he really like? Is he a nerd? Is he normal? And so I've come up with a scientific 10-question test that is validated. All the Ivy League universities that will confirm whether or not you're, in fact, a card-carrying nerd. Question number one, do you have an Instagram account?
No.
No.
Sorry.
Okay. How many cell phones have you purchased for yourself in the last year?
Three.
Three. That's a good number. That's a good number. Do you have a personal Twitter feed?
No.
Okay. Have you ever used Meerkat or Periscope?
No, I haven't.
You're thinking here. You're thinking,
yes, I'm
Tom.
Sorry.
You're not much of a nerd. What kind of a smartphone do you have?
An Android.
Android, okay. And what's the most popular app in that phone in the last 30 days?
Electronic signature.
Because
Tom's mobile all over the world.
I know. I had the people from that signature company on the air. Break into your house tonight. How many tablet devices do we find?
In our home, my wife Julie and I, there are seven.
Seven. Wow. Now you're getting
nerd
points,
buddy.
And I
give my wife a lot of credit.
You're getting nerd points here. Right. When was your most recent post in social networking?
Probably around 4 o'clock this morning.
Oh, now all of a sudden the needle's going all on the nerd side. Now you're coming to the nerd. And when is your Apple Watch due? Did you order the gold one?
My wife is really the Apple believer, disciple in the house, and I'm sure hers are on order. And then after I see it, I'll probably ask her how she likes it, and she'll say, I love it, and then I'll get one.
And the last book you read, Tom, was it paper or was it electronic?
Oh, it was electronic.
Ooh, you're a week early showing, but you're coming on strong. You're probably more 7 or 8 on the 10 scale for a nerd, so it's stronger to nerd than normal. And I always wonder what I would do if I had to take that test, but I'm given the test, and I'm not taking it. You know, you can read books about innovation. You can listen to podcasts about innovation. I'm sure we can go to events and hear you talk about innovation. But really, it's like so many things in life. You got to put your work boots on and jump in and make mistakes and break things and go, oh, I didn't know that. I remember the first time I started cooking for my family, it was a disaster. You know, the stove literally broke, and that I'd make three meals and three would be bad. I'd make another one and Dad, keep this recipe. And 20 years later, I've got like maybe 6 good recipes.
John, I totally agree with you. I say to young people all the time, you know, being the CEO and chairman of so many organizations throughout my career, you know, the young person comes in, the young lady, the young man come in and they're going to meet the CEO and he's got gray hair back there behind the desk. And one of the things that I say to all of them when they join the company, I welcome them. I say, we want to have a culture here of being a family. Please call on me at any time. And I say, don't be afraid to make a mistake. Show me someone that makes mistakes and I'll show you someone who's doing something. Don't be afraid to make a mistake. Try not to make the same mistake 10 times in a row. And by all means, come to me if you want to know about mistakes, because I've made plenty. And I can try to help you learn from the mistakes I made.
I think that's the key, is having maybe that's the key to innovation, is we can read the Christensen book, we can read about Steve Jobs, we've all read his biography, and there has to be environments where there is either extreme confidence or assurance that mistakes will be tolerated, because it's got to happen.
Absolutely, John. I think research shows time and time again that culture is critical in terms of creating new technologies, new capabilities, etc. I think it's critical. My style, people often ask, what's my style in terms of leadership? Very simply, it's a servant leader style. I'm about getting people together, reaching consensus, getting ideas from all components of the organization. When I put incentive compensation in an organization, everyone gets to participate in that. And I can tell you stories that are absolutely true in my career where people on the janitorial staff had phenomenal ideas that saved the company millions of dollars, because at night while they were cleaning up the company, they realized that we were having custom crates, for example, in some of our products, and said, you know, if all you did was put some padding in there, you could save tons of money. And that's how they would describe it. And I would have someone from finance do it, and it would save millions of dollars. And this is the kind of innovation needs to flourish in the right culture.
So we get a crystal ball out here, and you peer into the crystal ball because you are the Oracle of the Potomac. So what's going to happen 5-10 years down the road? Do you think Govy's going to get it? Are they going to start making changes? Innovation's going to be, they're obviously bringing you back. There must be some need here.
Well, I have to say that, you know, they're some of the best people I've ever met in my career in government. Some of the most humble heroes that I've ever met. So it was a real honor for me to serve in our government. And I think there's a Russian saying that loosely translated English that goes something, the money's running out. We have to be smarter. And I think that is germane in these days with the federal government. And I think senior executives in the government are realizing more and more that we need to work in partnership. People ask me all the time, you know, Dr. Salucci, Tommy, how is it that you've been successful in business? And I say in one word, partnerships. Just like I have a wonderful wife who's my partner, I chose well, and I was very, very fortunate who I partner with. It's the same in business. And for example, when we first started talking, John, we talked about our marketing alliance partner program. It's very critical. In the same way, we need to be able in the U.S. government to be able to partner in an open, fair, legal, and honest way with the private sector. Most of the people I know in the private sector in the corner offices want to help the federal government. It's not just about money. And I will tell you from personal experience, when I developed some of the innovative commercialization-based public-private partnership models, the OGC, the Office of General Counsel, no less than 20 lawyers looked at these programs. They were not blocks. They were supportive. And they would say to me, how come we didn't do this 25 years ago? So everything is right now in the government to get these innovative public-private partnerships working. And I'm not talking about the public-private partnerships that most of the listeners are familiar with, where the private sector pays for big public work projects. I'm talking about working together, using the skill sets to commercialize technology to help our government prevent cyber attacks, to help our citizenry protect infrastructure, etc.
I'm trying to connect the dots here. I'm thinking about your most popular app and your company, eCrypt. I'm thinking about eSign Life. That's one of your partners, isn't it?
It certainly is.
And so I guess the Redskins are learning this now in their training camp, is that, you know, get good people together, give them room to failure, give them good structure, and good things could possibly happen this year. We'll have to see. But with human beings, people are very wary sometimes of innovation because they're afraid that their job's going to be in line. But I think it has to be structured in a way that it's not life or death. It's an attempt at doing something new and different. And I never thought the lawyers would be behind it when you tell me that story.
The lawyers and the senior executives in government were phenomenal. And they're very rigorous, check things out, gave the full blessing after review, and couldn't have been more supportive. So things that people predicted to me would be roadblocks were not only not roadblocks, they enabled me to accelerate these models in government. And I have to say, both President Obama, President George W. Bush, Secretary Napolitano, Secretary Chertoff were not only supportive of what I was doing, they embraced it. And I will always appreciate them for that. It had nothing to do with politics.
Great. We're going to have to end this interview here. We've been talking about innovation. If you'd like to learn more about innovation, Tom's certainly written enough about it. CELLUCCI. You can go to eBay. You can go to Amazon. I'm sure you can go just to Google and find out more. If you'd like to find out more about his company and what kind of people he's partnering with, ECRYPTINC.com. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Tom Cellucci, Chief Executive Officer at Ecrypt Technologies. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, John.
You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. If you miss any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk, Tuesday mornings at 9, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.